Hello, and welcome to Plot Trysts. This is Meg. Today's episode is part of our limited series, My Word is Vorkosigan. These episodes deviate a bit from our regular Plot Trysts format. I'm not hosting them with Lane, but rather with historical romance author and fellow Lois McMaster Bujold superfan Alexandra Vasti. Instead of short, digestible book reviews, these episodes are longer discussions of each book in the Vorkosigan Saga series, and do involve major spoilers. If you're reading along with us, please feel free to join our Discord discussion. You can find an invitation link at our website, plottrysts.wordpress.com, or at the link in our Instagram bio, at plottrysts. Today's episode features the Vor Game, with guest host Ari Stearns, author of the Shieldrunner Pirates series.
We are again having an episode of My Word as Vorkosigan, a limited series release where we are reading all of the Vorkosigan books. Today, we're talking about the Vor Game. So I'm Meg. I'm here as usual with Alex. And today joining us is an author guest, R.E. Stearns. She's written the Shieldrunner Pirate series, starts with Barbary Station. So hi, everyone.
Welcome. We're so excited to have you here today.
Yeah. And so, yes, we're going to be reading The Vor Game. This was published in 1990, but the first few chapters of The Vor Game were actually originally published in a different format as a novella slash short story called The Weatherman in a magazine, an analog magazine.
So, yeah, this is something we're definitely going to talk about today, how the Weatherman section fits in with the rest of the book. Lots to say about that.
Exactly. So, Rue, why did you pick The Vor Game, when we invited you to be one of our author guests? You did choose The Vor Game.
Yeah, if you want to tell us a little bit about how you started reading The Vorkosigan Saga, just sort of tell us a little bit about your connection to it.
Well, I started reading The Vorkosigan Saga because everybody talks about it. So I have been hearing about it for a long time and eventually just said, okay, I'm going to start. And then, of course, you go to like pick up the series and there are essays about where you should start.
Right.
So I ended up with chronological order, but yeah, and I've just really enjoyed the characters and the world building and everything about it, honestly. And in particular, the Vor Game has so much fun intrigue. It's got some of my favorite characters, and Miles is like origin story is a chunk of it is in here, and it's very charming. It's like it's just a nice point in his story before everything else happens to him.
Yes.
So I wouldn't say he's like naive necessarily, but he definitely is still kind of building his view of the universe and his place in it in this one, and I find that to be really entertaining to read.
It's definitely a young Miles book for sure. That's something we've talked about. Meg and I have
talked. Yes. So I personally am a middle-aged Miles girl. I like really like him a little older, but having the chance to reread the books with this read along has been really fun because I am realizing that young Miles is also really wonderful to read. And maybe I just am forgetting that it's so great because I love middle-aged Miles. I don't know.
I feel like, now, had you read, I was just recently reading Barbary Station and definitely feel like I see some, like, I can see why you picked this book. Just this, like, the space sort of, like, fun and excitement and, you know, just all of the hijinks. Had you read the Vorkosigan books before you wrote your series or after?
Oh, I must have read some before. And I cannot think where they would have picked up because this was actually a little bit ago. Publishing moves very slowly, so I think I was writing this book in Barbary Station in like 2017 or something, so that's a bit far back for me to remember what order I read what in. Sorry.
No, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to get overly chronological there.
I never remember like what my influences are. People are always saying, oh, it's so interesting that you did this thing this way. And I'm like, oh, did I?
Thank you for telling me that. Let me write it down. All right. So let me give a little overview of the Vor Game, which is there's a lot of plot in this one. So I will try to give an overview that makes sense. So when we meet Miles, the opening of the Vor Game, he is graduating from the academy and everybody is like opening their assignments, and everyone is hoping for ship duty. Miles opens his assignment and he finds out that he has been assigned to be the chief meteorological officer at a base that he's never even heard of, Laskowski Base, which is on Kuril Island, known as Camp Permafrost. And Miles is horrified. He's like, did I forget when we studied meteorology? So he is like flabbergasted that he's been given this assignment, but he is told that he has been given this assignment because he has a problem with subordination, which we know about Miles very well. And so they tell Miles that if he can keep his nose clean and keep his head down for 6 months and prove that he is able to be a subordinate, he will get a ship duty assignment on the brand new Prince Serg, which is the newest, fastest, you know, most badass spaceship. So he goes off to Kuril Island. He is like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to keep my head down. Immediately is, you know, rubs the wrong way with his superior officer, who's called Metsov. And he ends up getting into it with Metsov. Metsov is trying to force some of his people to clean up a chemical weapons spill. They refuse. Metsov decides it's a mutiny. Miles ends up getting involved to try to save these men who are in danger of freezing to death in the weather at Camp Permafrost. He basically sort of semi-sacrifices himself and is like, all right, Metsov, like, do you want to have to explain this to IMSEC when they come to find out why I'm dead? And so he of course, you know, it becomes part of this mutiny. And because he's a Vor, ends up getting charged with treason again. Like, Miles, come on, stop doing treason. So they, of course, everyone agrees that he has actually done the right thing, that this was a criminal order from Metsov. They kind of decide to sort of get him out of the way. He's in solitary confinement for a while. And what ends up happening is that they decide he's, you know, his military career is basically over. The only option is to assign him directly to Simon Ilyen, to poor Simon's dismay. So after his sort of little punishment is over, he is sent off to the Hagen hub. He's given a new commanding officer, Angari. And Angari and Miles go off to the Hagen hub. Miles is told to potentially, he might have to reactivate the Admiral Naismith persona. In the meantime, he is undercover as an arms dealer. While he is undercover as an arms dealer, some weird things happen, or his contact dies. He meets a sort of sexy lady called Livia New, who, you know, things happen and he ends up getting arrested and sort of separated from his IMSEC team. While he is in prison, he gets tossed into the same cell as who should it be but Emperor Gregor. Emperor Gregor is there, who we find out had a kind of depressive episode after discovering the truth about his father and his father's sort of evil past. He has a sort of, you know, maybe suicide attempt, and he ends up escaping. He runs away from his job as emperor, sneaks off, and unfortunately, you know, it doesn't go super well for him, and he's jailed for vagrancy. I think he has no money and it's not going super well. So Miles is like, oh my God, you know, Gregor thinks Miles is there to rescue him. It's just a complete coincidence that they're there in the same cell. Miles is attempting to rescue and extricate him from prison. They end up re-encountering the Dendari. They are recaptured. The Livia New, the sexy spy lady, turns out to be in charge of a competing mercenary force called Randall's Rangers. She captures Miles and Gregor, decides that she wants to marry Gregor and become the Empress of Beriar. So in order to achieve that, she sends Miles back to the Dendari, tells him to retake the Dendari, who've been sort of taken back over by Oser, who we remember from Warrior's Apprentice. So he does that and realizes, sort of comes to the conclusion that Cavillo, this woman who used to be Livia New, is actually part of a plot for a Cetaganda invasion of the Hagen hub that's going to give Cetaganda power over Beriar, sort of wormhole access and control. So he thinks that Cavillo is trying to go back on that and become Empress instead. He outwits her, gets Gregor back. Gregor also sort of rises to the occasion as well. They repel the Cetaganan invasion with the power of the Dendari and like sheer will. Fortunately, Beriar comes in time and everyone sort of works together. Errol Vor Kosigan comes in person to command the the Beriaran fleet. They repel the Cetagandans. Gregor kind of finally comes into his own as emperor and sort of officially, like he has been the emperor unofficially, but now he like, or he, sorry, he's been the emperor officially, but now he kind of unofficially as well, like really takes the power from Simon and from Errol and kind of comes into his own at the end of the book. Then what they end up deciding to do is finally actually use the Dondarrion instead of kind of just letting them languish. And Miles is going to be Admiral Naismith on a more permanent basis. And that is the end.
Phew.
I know.
There's so much that happens in this book. When I reread it, I was like I had forgotten some of the things. Like when he gets thrown in jail and then he wakes up and Gregor is there, I was like, oh my God, I forgot about that.
Yeah. I'd
love to see like a timeline that shows where the different characters diverge and then converge.
Yes.
Because there's like, it starts before the book starts with different people knowing each other and they lose touch and they come back together. It's amazing.
Yeah, right. The whole Dondarrion, like all of that is set up in Warrior's Apprentice, and then they are like having their own adventures for years before the, you know, before the book even begins.
Yeah.
No, I had read this one initially, and then I don't think I re-picked it up until earlier this year, actually. And for some reason in my mind, I was like, oh yeah, that's the Kuril Island book. But that's like the first third. Like I had completely forgotten that all the rest of this other stuff is the same book.
Yes.
So I want to talk about that first. Why are these two sections in the same book? Because to some extent, you know, she wrote the Kuril Island stuff as its own separate thing, and it does a little bit feel like a separate story. So why are these smushed into one book? Why are they together? What are they doing? What work do they do having them both in one book?
Well, my hypothesis is that she wanted to make sure you understood who some important people were and how they interacted with Miles before you see them again.
Right.
Because, you know, we might not have taken, for example, Metzelfus seriously if we hadn't seen him already.
Right.
Being mm-hmm. bastard.
I mean, I think that one of the big themes of the series is like characters and their honor, right? That's, I mean, it's set up literally in the very first book, Shards of Honor. And so we see this temptation in Kuril Island for Miles to not do what he thinks is right, right? He wants the Prince Zurg so bad. Like that is his heart's desire in this moment. And so he has this like temptation to just, I mean, literally Metzelf says, go away, go back to your meteorology office. He has like this easy out. And so I think, you know, it's one of the places where we see Miles like facing sort of an early ethical test to his honor and his integrity. And, you know, obviously succeeding in that test, which he's not always going to do.
Yeah. It's, I have also recently read another book. We're trying not to spoil too much of the series, but thinking of how he begins his career in the military, and specifically in IMSEC, and then how it ends, it's a very nice parallel, in fact, which is of course fascinating. Like we keep talking about how Joel just manages to keep these threads going for books and books and books and books, but it really works as these two bookends.
Yeah,
it does balance a lot of her elements really well. I thought about that actually with just about all of the major choices that Miles has to make. Like the choices are so evenly weighted in some ways. Like when he was making that decision to not take Metzoff's invitation to leave that scene, he was also deciding, okay, this is, you know, a politically iffy choice. And also I might freeze to death.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
More likely to freeze to death than any of these other people.
Yes.
So it's, yeah, Bujold has all kinds of just those like really well-balanced choices where the character is really in a tight place making that decision.
Yes.
Yes, she does. She makes it so you could really see them going either way, right?
Yeah.
You could totally see how that is a real difficult choice. And you can imagine that character kind of having to really grapple with their options.
Yeah. And I feel like this book too. So she has that very famous quote, which is, well, how do you structure your books? And she said, I think of the worst thing I can do this character and then I do it and see how they react. And that's been taken out of context a lot. I get it, but I think it works really well in this book specifically because we're looking not only at Miles making decisions and having this bad thing happen to him, but the fact that Miles is like, could be court-martialed and then how it reflects on Errol when you see Errol enter the scene and he's just like beaten down and like his hopes for what Miles was going to be and how he was going to modernize Barriar have been dashed as well. I just think it's, and then Gregor, I mean, everything, every character in this book, like something awful just happens to that person. Like even Metzov, like what's the worst thing that can happen to Metzov? Happens to him, you know?
Right.
This is the book where it's perfect, right?
I think like, you're so right. And it's so just like gripping and poignant when they sort of scoop up Miles and, you know, Simon, they have, you know, Miles is coming into Simon's office to get called out of the carpet as he always does. And instead Simon says, you know, how could you betray him? So he had such hopes of you. And it was like, I felt like my heart was being like ripped out. I was like, no, like Miles is the thing, you know? But then of course, thank God, Errol agrees and says, you know, And I like the two, the Errol's quote is like, Miles says, did I do the right thing? And Errol says, you did a right thing.
Right. And he says, like, you can't, he's not going to second guess him because he wasn't there, which is so practical.
He was like, you were the man on the ground.
Right. Yes. He makes it a policy not to second guess his field commanders. Like, Errol is so just, he's a good dad and he's a good commander. Errol is just such a good character.
As I was rereading this one, there was a moment that I had forgotten, which was that he was the whole time Miles was a child. He was Errol was taking these long lunches to spend time with him every day. That's so sweet.
I know. Those lines were really beautiful. I mean, I definitely teared up when I know exactly the moment you're talking about. And he says, like, you know, to sit down on the floor with his son who couldn't walk and talk to him and, you know, they were good parents for Miles.
I know. And then it makes it even more heartbreaking for you as a reader to see Errol reacting to this child that he's raised. Everything. Yeah,
it's really good. So the other thing that I feel like that the Carol Island section does is it builds this pattern for Miles and for the character that we're going to get to know over many books, which is that Miles can't or won't play by the rules when he thinks he knows better. Even if it is in his best interest, he will not just, I mean, he's, you know, he even says like at the end of the book, something like, I couldn't play ensign when what was needed was Lord Vorkosigan or Admiral Naismith, right? If he thinks he knows better, he is going to just take over the situation.
I mean, it works so perfectly when he has his three commanding officers in the brig like lined up right next to each other.
Elena's like, awfully hard on your superior officers, aren't you, Miles?
Right. But I mean, that starts from the beginning. The beginning, he's like, you have a problem with authority. With taking orders. And he's like, no, I don't. And he's like, oh, sir, you know.
Before he can even have a conscious thought about it, he is already arguing or speaking up when he maybe shouldn't.
I think the other thing about this book too is that it's so funny. Like, it could be really dark and depressing because a lot of really dark and depressing stuff happens in this book, but it's so funny that you don't get bogged down on in that part of it.
Yeah. She definitely keeps the tone lighter in this one. Like all the scenes with like Miles and Cavillo interacting are absolutely hilarious. Like the very first moment she's like trying to seduce him and he's like going back and forth about like whether it like, but maybe it would be in character to allow himself to be seduced.
He's having an out of body experience trying to figure out what should happen there.
And then he's like, gotta get out of here. I love it. It's so comical.
Yeah.
Oh man. It really is so funny. Like there's where he's like in, you know, he's been captured by Randall's Rangers and he's like, maybe I'll macrame help with the threads from my jacket. And then he gets to like HEL and like it gets caught on his cuticle and like his help falls apart. I mean, it's so just like goofy and funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's such good comedy.
But this is one where we were talking as we were starting to record about how Bujold is kind of finding her way as an author and like writing a plot. And this plot really feels like you don't know what's going on. I mean, Miles doesn't know what's going on. And so you as the reader reading through Miles's POV don't know what's going on, but she does wrap it up really well in the end. Like it's really well tied up. So I thought this was kind of an interesting one compared to some of her earlier books. This one, I think she knew her end point and knew where she was going.
Well, I don't know. I feel like I don't want to totally disagree with you, but like a lot of the plot elements are like really coincidental. Like,
oh yeah,
Miles just like getting thrown into the cell with Gregor is like there's absolutely no like in narrative logic to that.
And when like, Metzoff shows up as part of Randall's Rangers.
Whereas like something with, well, okay, I don't want to like spoil, but like some of the later books, like she sort of sets up all these set pieces and then they kind of naturally entwine in a way that makes in narrative sense. Whereas like with this one, I don't know that I think it makes in narrative sense per se, although so I enjoyed the ride.
Maybe this is then the midpoint between the beginning and like these are things happening and the later books where she knows exactly what's going on all the way through. Here she knew the end and she knew the characters and she's like, they're going to get together somehow.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I know we've talked about more than once now about the Elizabeth Hoyt series Maiden Lane. So I don't know, Rue, if you are a romance reader at all, but Meg and I are both romance fans and specifically historical romance. And so there is a series that we've talked about, a long intertwined series similar to this called Maiden Lane by Elizabeth Hoyt, which is a historical romance. And it's also very plot heavy. And Elizabeth Hoyt also tends to sometimes rely on the like, and then they showed up here. And oh, and then here, look, this person just happens to walk in who you met, you know, five chapters ago. I definitely feel like there's, I don't know, just it's definitely like too coincidental. But it's fun. It's a fun ride.
Mm-hmm. I think it adds to the humor too. Like when Metzoff shows up, you're like, oh, of course Metzoff shows up, you know?
Yeah. Like in some ways it's like, this might as well happen. And on the other hand, it's like, no, this would definitely happen to Miles.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Right. There is something almost kind of like supernatural about Miles, especially young Miles, the way things just happen to him. And like, the way he's able to like retake the Dondarri is so ridiculous. And yet, you know, you just believe it because Miles is such a force. Like, it's like, all right, if anyone can retake their mercenary force in a pair of slippers, it's going to be Miles. So, all right, I want to talk about Gregor because I feel like this book is really a Gregor book. Like the arc, there's not a huge growth arc for Miles. There's a little bit of a growth arc for Miles, but in some ways it's just kind of like setting some Miles patterns that the rest of the series is going to work through. But I actually think that the real growth arc in this book belongs to Gregor. What do you guys think?
He definitely started out with room to grow. And yeah. I don't just say that because of his first major decision in the story, which was maybe not a decision of going off the balcony head first. But before that, something that he had said toward the beginning was, I'm trying to remember the exact line, something like, not only did he decide that like a plastic figure could replace him in many of his official events, which was very sad to hear, but also just how he never seemed to be able to assert like his control, despite being the entire emperor of an entire country. He could not get people to listen to him at all.
Right. Like he even says to Miles, like, you know, like if I ordered you to do this, would you? And Miles is like,
immediately.
Yeah, totally. But then Miles is also like, but I will also, you know, don't follow any of my superior officer's orders. So it's not just you.
It's not just you, Gregor.
But yeah, I agree. I think Gregor has a lot of character work. I think this is something interesting that Bujold does too, is she doesn't shy away from like suicidal tendencies in her characters. Miles yeah. has thought about committing suicide, in this book, Gregor basically tries to die by suicide, but
I think it's a little open-ended and
kind of gets caught, and he was like, well, as soon as I threw myself over, I tried to stop,
right?
But I mean, he started it, you know.
Yeah.
And throughout he's got this, you know, there's the call of the void, right?
Yeah.
For Gregor. Well,
and so we just saw in Warrior's Apprentice where Gregor like fucks up, like mm-hmm. tries to, you know, assert himself and be a little bit more in charge and maybe break away from like this power that is Errol Vorkosigan. And he does it wrong. You know, mm-hmm. he makes a big mistake. And so I can see, and he's only 25 years old, you know, like the narrative takes a point, makes a point of reminding us that he's only 25. Like, I feel like he's just in this moment where he is really vulnerable, where he's feeling like he doesn't have control over himself, over his own life. Everything is outside of his hands. And when he does attempt to take control, he messes up, you know, repeatedly. So I think that for all that Errol, you know, we just were saying Errol's a great character, he's a great dad, but he does control Gregor a lot. And I think that it's, you know, he has to be sort of forced to let go of the reins a little bit. I part of me, like, we don't really see Errol and everyone like panicking for all this time, but it's sort of nice to imagine them all like running around, like freaking out. I'm like, where's Gregor? How did he vanish?
Yeah.
Tearing the place apart.
Yeah.
But one thing, like, when he starts off, you know, in that miserable, vulnerable place, and then as he starts to get, like, he starts to see opportunities to act, he actually, in this one, avails himself pretty well a lot of the time. I won't say all the time. But, you know, in a lot of the scenes where, like, Miles needs immediate assistance to not be squashed by some bigger opponent, he will step in pretty quickly and pretty effectively. Gregor will.
Yeah, and he thinks on his feet. He makes good snap decisions. I mean, we see him being, like, a worthy, you know, emperor here.
Yes.
Like, there's all the times where he's, like, in, you know, they're in the cell and Gregor is protecting him really smartly and distracting the people and coming up with clever things to say. He splits his rations with Miles, you know, without, you know, even thinking twice about it. I mean, we see that he's, like, a really good guy, which, you know, given his dad, was not necessarily a given. So yeah. it's a relief for Beriar.
I feel like one of the things we read about a lot in this book is about how Beriar is just very unhealthy for everyone. Yep. Unless you are, like, even if you are a Vor male, like, it's still a really unhealthy environment for you. Gregor's not thriving. Obviously, Miles is not thriving. Elena left and she's like, yeah, it's my home, but I'm not going back there. Anyway, it's just, to me, a really interesting thing that Bujold does to create Beriar as this place that everyone is trying to escape from or change, or it's never been a utopic place. So I don't know. It's interesting here.
Maximum drama.
Yeah.
Everything is balanced on a smallish number of people, especially from Miles and Gregor's perspectives. So anybody who makes any mistakes, you know, there's suddenly 20 people and a small town involved and it's a disaster. Like, maybe they, you know, in a different, some of the other areas, they don't have everything balanced quite so much on, say, a monarchy. Mm-hmm. So there's more distribution of responsibility.
Cordelia would point out the superiority of Beta Colony and their government.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
No, one of them anyways, Beta Colony does better.
So I think one of the things that makes Gregor's arc fun as a reader is that, like, we don't actually know if he's been taken in by Cavillo. So we're in Miles' head, you know, Miles has been captured by Randall's Rangers. He's just, like, sitting around in solitary confinement for the second time in one book. It's a lot of solitary confinement for one book. And Cavillo turns up and she's like, so tell me about your mom. And he's like, why are we talking about my mom? And she's like, so can an off-worlder be accepted by Beriar in society if they marry into it? And he's like, yeah, I guess so. And then sort of slowly comes to realize that she's positioning herself as empress. And he is like, oh my God, like, is Gregor encouraging this? And if so, is he doing it because, you know, because he's being strategic, or is he actually falling for her? And this is a real valid, you know, worry for Miles, because he himself found, you know, the draw of Cavillo. And we don't know. And we sort of are in this suspense with Miles. And I think it makes it really, you know, you're really invested and you're really hooked up until the very, very, like, incredibly dramatic cinematic moment when Gregor kind of turns on her. It's so good.
There's kind of a repeating motif of Miles not trusting his judgment. And, you know, sometimes he's actually wrong and sometimes he's not. So we can't tell from his record in this very book whether he's correct about this or not. Yeah. Even about Gregor, like what he can count on Gregor for, he is not sure about that through most of the story.
Yeah. I absolutely love the scene where he's like, he's retaken the Dondarri and he's talking with Cavillo and he like launches into this whole speech about how like he, you know, he's like, she's like, if you don't do what I want, I'm going to kill Gregor. And he's like, fine, do it. You know, and he's like, we know that he's bluffing, but he's like, he makes this incredibly convincing speech where like, oh, if you kill Gregor, like I'd be the next in line. And hey, maybe you should, you know, think about marrying me. Are you thinking about your emperors? And then he like Cavillo then like plays this back for Gregor. And oh my God, it's so fun. And it's also so like just suspenseful because you don't know what Gregor believes or what side.
And Elena's listening to the thing too. Like Elena falls out of her chair because she's like, what is Miles saying?
Yeah. And Gregor is like, he's always, you know, muttering those things to himself. It's so funny.
It's so funny. Oh my gosh. And then at the very end, when they bring him in as a hostage, and Miles is like, drop him or I shoot. He's like, I had to say it before they did.
It's so good. Yeah. So basically Miles is like, basically both of them want to use Gregor as a pawn. So Miles is like, all right, I'm going to say it first. So that because if she wants to use Gregor as a pawn, she might actually use Gregor as a pawn. Whereas I know I actually won't. It would just be a bluff from my end. But then, Gregor, like, super dramatically walking. I mean, like, it's a bluff and walking right up to the cannon while everybody is watching. And then that enables them to capture Cavillo. It's so good.
It's so good.
So what do you think about the part where Miles is like, I didn't know if we were taken in by Cavillo or not. And Gregor's like, no, of course I wasn't. You know, I was taken in by the, you know, people in Warrior's Apprentice. But I wish she'd been real. What do we think about that part?
I mean, to me, it's so you have to understand too, Ruth, that when I read these books, I'm like looking for the romance trope. This is the fortune hunter romance trope right here. Like she's looking for what she can get out of him. But if this were a romance novel, they would fall in love and then she would feel bad about it and like let him go. And then they would meet up later and she'd be like, oh, I let you go because, you know, I knew they could never accept me or whatever. And so this was like very romance moment for me right here. When he's like, oh, if only it had been true. Like this is the third act conflict in a fortune hunter romance is they have the breakup and the person with the fortune is like, if only they had actually loved me, like I was willing to give up everything for them, you know? So that's what it was for me. But it's also Gregor being a person and not an emperor, right? So he's like, I wish she did love me. Like anyone would love me for who I am and not the position that I have. So it's both a romance thing, but also like this is how I'm sure figureheads feel, you know?
And also yeah. It was another one of those beautiful visual balanced choices because not only, you know, I mean, it would have been one thing if she had been trying to seduce him and he was just like, oh, I see what you're doing. But no, he saw what she was doing, but also she was a really wild, amazing in several senses of the word person. And it was, you know, if there had been any possibility for that, I bet he will be thinking about this for years and be thinking about her for like, if there any way this could have worked out, you know, because she was so different from any of the other people that either one of these guys interacted with on a regular basis, let alone any of the other women that they interact with regularly.
And then there's that amazing line too, where Miles is like, wow, you captured Brandel's Rangers single-handedly. And Gregor is like, oh no, it definitely took both hands.
I love that line. So I'm so glad you brought that up. Yes. Well, and you know, I mean, Miles thinks like, Gregor probably hasn't like had a lot of like sexual experience either. Yeah. Like, you know, like himself, they've been pretty sheltered, which is interesting. And in some ways it kind of goes against you know, like a lot of historical romance where we have like a, you know, an aristocratic character, like, oh, they've just had, you know, gobs of sexual experience. And Gregor is, you know, obviously like the mega aristocrat in this in Beriar. But, you know, it makes sense that he has been sheltered. He's kind of shy. He's not like the kind of, you know, he's not Ivan. He's not going to go out and seek out like female companionship necessarily. So, you know, this is probably like a pretty transformative experience for Gregor in many ways.
I kind of wonder if the people who were in charge of setting up his social schedule, for example, were thinking, oh, we need to be careful about the kind of women he might meet. We maybe don't want to introduce him to this person or that person. So this is another moment when the training wheels are off for him and he has to make his own decision about this.
And he makes the right decision. One of the things that I like too is that when they, you know, they capture Cavillo, you know, Miles is in charge of the Dondarri again. But the first thing he does is present Gregor with like a list of options. He's like, you know, Cider, you can do this, you can do this, you can do this. And I really like that because it does show, I think, a little bit of a shift, because I think in the later books, we do see Miles like really committed to his service to Gregor. Like he really sees himself as, you know, he doesn't serve a lot of people, but he serves Gregor and he serves Beriar. And I think this is one of the first places where we see Miles kind of turning the decision over to Gregor and saying like, this is up to you, this is your choice. And it doesn't feel, you know, like something he feels like he's supposed to do. Like, it feels like that's really like the right thing to do in that moment. So I feel like Gregor really, you know, it's just a sign that Gregor has kind of taken this mantle in a really very real way.
Yeah. And that Miles is there to whatever he chooses to support him. So.
Right.
I like that.
And, too. You know, I mean, and he really tests that because Gregor is like, you know, I want to fight. Like, I want to be on the ship. And so, you know, Miles is not going to not push back. But, you know, he says, what does he say? Something like, well, if you feel like the best way you can serve, sir, is, you know, on a ship as a regular soldier, then I will support you. And Gregor is like, oh, okay.
And Gregor was like, ah, it's like, fine. God.
I really like how at the end as well, we get Errol like coming and seeing Miles in action. He gets to see Miles in his Admiral Naismith persona. It's just really touching, this reunion. Like, we can see how worried Errol has been, and just kind of seeing his like relief and his pride in Miles is so lovely and so touching. I think with Warrior's Apprentice, like, Miles achieves a lot and does a lot of great stuff, but you know, he doesn't get recognized, really. Mm-hmm. He pretty much gets the opposite of recognized. So it's really great to see Miles succeed and have his successes be recognized and recognized by the person who it really matters to him, which is Errol.
I know. I totally agree. It's so nice. And I love the part where he walks in and he gives him a big hug.
I know.
I know it's like the dumbest thing to love, but I just like love it when he gives him a hug.
It was very emotional with the hug.
Oh, no.
It definitely got to me.
Oh yeah, totally.
And also, this is the part where you know, we learn that Gregor has finally stood up to Errol, and you know, Miles is like, I was really surprised that you let Gregor do blah blah blah, and Errol's like, yes, I did do that, didn't I? And Miles is like, wait a second, you didn't let him, he ordered you to do that. It's really satisfying to see that. And I think Errol has this very sort of like moment of wisdom where he says the most morally dangerous moment for a guardian is when the temptation to become a puppet master seems most rational, right? Yes. And you can totally see that it would seem, you know, again, back to, you know, Rue's discussion of choices, like that this is a real moment of ethical choice for Errol. Like, it would seem very rational to him that he, you know, to order Gregor, no, you can't be on the ship, it's too dangerous. But he has to sort of accept that Gregor is the emperor, that, you know, for all this time he's been saying that's his goal, but his goal has arrived. Like, he has to step down and let Gregor do what Gregor thinks is right, even if he himself thinks that, you know, it might be a mistake.
Yeah, absolutely. And then when Ilion too talks about retirement, like, they're both like, maybe someday we actually can retire.
Like, it takes a while.
Yeah, well, I mean, yes, it does take quite a while.
I think that there are a lot of places in the book where choice and the extent to which these characters have choices is really interrogated. We have, you know, a couple examples that we've already talked about with their individual choices, but also just kind of like their larger choices in terms of Gregor not wanting to be emperor, right? Mm-hmm. He talks about how I can be replaced by, you know, by a statue. He feels like he's been born into this role. He doesn't have a choice, and that the choices that he makes as emperor, he feels, at least in that moment, that they don't really make a difference, that they don't really matter. And also, you know, the Vor, like, similarly, just like, you know, obviously Gregor is Vor and sort of like the ultimate Vor, the platonic right. Vor. But Miles too, as Vor Kosigan, you know, he's born into that role and he has to take it on. And so for him, it's a role that he wants, but, you know, maybe that's not necessarily true for all the Vor like Gregor.
Right. But I mean, I do think that as the Vor, that Gregor has even more responsibility than the others. Like, his entire life is to serve.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just, you know, I'm going to serve in the Council of Counts or I'm going to serve in the military. It's everything I do, every moment of every day.
Yeah. No, I think you're exactly right. And I think that, that is going to play out so much too with, you know, with his marriage, with it, you know, I mean, all of those things are things that have political ramifications. I just really enjoy Gregor as a character. I love when he's like, I really enjoyed the light bulbs. I was getting pretty good at that. You know, yeah. Like very like super dry sense of humor. You wonder like what Gregor would have been like if he weren't emperor.
Yes, I like it too. I remember in Warrior's Apprentice, I remember, because it comes right after Beriar. And in Beriar, the end of that book is very much like, oh, Cordelia's like, oh, do they realize what they're doing? Like, I'm going to be raising the next emperor. And you're kind of like, oh, great. Like, we're going to see this emperor who has been raised by Cordelia. And at first, you don't see, at least not in Warrior's Apprentice, in my opinion, you don't really see much of Cordelia's influence, right? You also right. don't see Miles as being like his brother.
Right.
Which is how they were supposedly, at least at the end of Beriar, you feel like that's how they're going to be raised, right?
Right.
But that's addressed in this book, which yeah. I thought was great. You know, like why they don't feel necessarily like foster brothers, why there are, you know, these differences in the relationship. And then here you do see like Gregor does not underestimate Cavillo.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Which is one of the things she talks about too.
And there's a lot of discussion about the fact that Cavillo is like Miles, but I think Cavillo is like sort of like an evil Cordelia Miles.
Yes. You know? Exactly. So of course
Gregor is not going to underestimate her because he grew up with Cordelia and Miles.
Exactly. Whereas,
you know, Metzov absolutely does underestimate her over and over and over and over. Like, no matter what she does, he continues to underestimate her until she shoots him in the head.
Yes. So you bring that up. That I think there are a couple of problematic elements in this one that I want to mention really briefly. So first is the way Bujal talks about suicide. Like, she talks about it being Gregor's secret shame.
Oh, yes. I noticed that too on this reread, and I don't know. I wasn't sure how to take that because I totally agree that it could be interpreted as like his you know, suicide attempt itself is shameful. But I think part of what Miles is upset about is the fact that he vanishes, and this could potentially have had catastrophic effects on Komar and caused violence mm-hmm. and bloodshed on Komar.
Yeah.
And that I think is something that Gregor, you know, does need to grapple with and need yep. to think about the ramifications of his actions. So I totally agree that if you read that as referring specifically to a suicide attempt, it's very problematic.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I just think it's interesting because it's not something that struck me when I first listened to it. But on this reread, I was like, oh, that's kind of an interesting choice of phrase. I mean, I think it's also...
Go ahead.
I would say it's also because this is the Beriar in perspective, right? So. Right.
But at the end, you know, Miles says, I'm not going to let this go until you talk to someone. He's like, I'm not going to, you know, reveal it, but you have to talk to someone. There is a lot of like therapy in the series. And I think that this is, maybe this was before Bujold had really like thoroughly conceptualized Bateman therapy, because I definitely feel like if this were like the 10th book in the series, you know, we would have talked about Bateman therapy right there. But it definitely, yes. You know, I think that that is for sure something that it's not brushed aside. It's no. It's definitely something that, you know, that Miles takes seriously, that he wants Gregor to address. Although, you know, rather than therapy, they're like, just talk to Cordelia. But it's not perfect. But I appreciate that it wasn't just sort of like skipped over.
Yeah. Yes. And then the other thing is that at the end of the book, it's heavily implied that Cavillo is raped by Metzoff. Yep.
That, oh, yeah. I would go beyond implied and say it's basically stated.
Yeah. Yeah. So just to, you know, mention that.
Yeah. I mean, and then she shoots him in the head. So there's some immediate justice, graphic justice meted out. And you know, sexual assault of women is not something that this series is new to this series.
Nope, it's not.
And it's also not the first time that we see a graphic justice
for
that.
No. So no, I mean in fact it's back-to-back books.
Oh yeah, you're right. It is. Yeah. It is back books. We see, that happening. Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't really put that together until right now when we were talking about it.
Yeah. I mean, really, the first three books in the series do grapple with sexual assault, in different ways. So
yeah,
but
yeah.
Anyway,
and I think that Bujold is. I think this was certainly, you know, a common part of genre fiction in the 80s and 90s. And I think that she doesn't just like toss it in for, you know.
I agree with you. It's treated very seriously.
Yep.
It's not something that she brushes aside. She's writing military science fiction. So this is MIL-SF. It's not just straight like science fiction. It's not just speculative fiction. And sexual assault is a big part of like military actions. So I think that that's also part of the reason why it's included.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And I think I in general, as a general rule, feel that she handles it pretty well.
Yeah, I agree. But I did want to just point those two things out.
Yeah, for sure. All right. The only other thing that I wanted to talk about was the fact that we get a discussion of Miles having a problem with authority because he is raised in the context of everyone who's in a position of authority is like related to him or his foster brother.
Yes.
And it really helps explain some of why Miles is the way Miles is. Like if the number one most significant person in the country is like your brother, or not in the country, in the whole world is your brother, like, of course you're going to not quite view your superiors with the level of whatever that you're supposed to, subordination that you're supposed to have.
On the other hand, I do see this as a little bit of as an excuse on Miles's part. He's like, how can I be expected to understand how to follow the, you know, military authority when I grew up with my dad as the regent and my foster brother's the emperor and my uncle was Simon? Like, it's not my fault.
Right. Ivan was raised similarly and he seems to have a perfectly healthy respect for authority.
He seems to be fine.
Yeah. I mean, I think that at this point in the series, we have only seen Miles kind of succeed other than like a few small moments, like the beginning of Warrior's Apprentice. Right. But like, other than that, Miles is, you know, he is testing out what happens if he does whatever the hell he wants. And the answer to that test seems to be succeed, you know, win.
Nothing right? too so, bad. Yeah.
Right. So she is setting Miles on a path that is, you know, going to accelerate. And well, we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
All right. Unfortunately, I think we have officially lost Ari Stearns, but it was very nice of her to join us.
She said she was swapping out a cable, so she may join us for the very end, but I think we can move forward.
Yeah. All right. Do you want to talk about how this fits in with the wider Volcosaverse?
Sure. So I just want to mention that we meet Lieutenant Joel for the first time.
Oh.
So just mentioning it, if you've glanced at the books in the series, then you know that one of the books is called Gentleman Joel and the Red Queen. So we can assume
that the same Joel.
Yes, so it is the same Joel. We can assume he's going to be an important character. That said, he's only on the page in two very brief scenes and has like maybe one line of dialogue in this book. So don't expect too much from Joel. He's back.
Yeah, but he's there. Like, he's not a late addition. He's there. She is setting him up. Okay. All right. So I saw that you put, why do Vorkosigan references, that you put Kuril Island. Does Kuril Island come back? Because I don't remember that at all.
Kuril Island is mentioned on, is referenced on several occasions. So I just want to mention that this is the first book. This is the only book that ever takes place on Kuril Island, but we hear about Kuril Island from other characters in other books.
I thought it was interesting that Errol is like, I was on Kuril Island once. Like, I really love like when we have these little references to what our main characters' backstories that we don't even know about. It's like, oh, who knew?
Yes. Well, and it was his time in between the invasion of Komar and when he was on the whatever the ship was in Shards of Honor. Mm-hmm. The Vor.
Yeah.
Can't remember the name of it. It's a Vor something. Cordelia. Oh gosh, yeah. The Vor. I can't remember the name.
That's all right. Yes. So I think that I really like that. I like that we see that he, I mean, you know, it's something that we already knew about Errol, but it's nice to be reminded of the fact that he has had points, extreme low points in his career as well. Just like, you know, just like Miles, right? Miles has many career setbacks, some of which he's already faced, some of which are still to come. And this is something that Errol totally understands and gets and, you know, has experienced as well. Although it's interesting because I don't know if Miles totally gets that. Like, we get it because we've spent books with Errol. But I don't know if Miles really understands that his father hasn't always been the great man.
Yes. There are some really interesting parts in other books that we'll talk about later, too, where I think Miles has to reckon with his conception of his parents.
Mm.
And what they were like and what his experience was like. It's really fascinating, especially when we get to... Never mind. Especially when we get to other books.
Other books. Yeah, well, no, I mean, I think that, you know, we know about Komar and what Errol's, you know, experience with Komar was and the disaster of that. And, you know, that is something that Miles kind of only knows that story from the Barry Aron perspective, from Errol's perspective. But that's not the only perspective of that story. And definitely other people have a very different perspective on Errol. That, you know.
Yeah, sorry about that. I think I killed a laptop.
Oh no. Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
We're talking about some of the wider Vorkosigan references. So we talked about how this is the first book where Joel appears. Of Gentleman Joel.
Yes.
We talked about Kuril Island. And then on this reread, I noticed that Simon talks about finally retiring and getting this damn chip out of my head.
Yes.
Yeah. It's very interesting. It's interesting, too, because that seems to be something that he thinks is very doable in that kind of like throwaway line. And yeah, I wonder if that's, I mean, you know, that's something that definitely is going to play out later in the series. And I wonder if she had that plotted out or if she just kind of was like, we'll see how that happens.
I mean, that's the question. Like thinking about Joel, thinking about the Illyrian chip, thinking about Kuril Island, which gets referenced later. But, you know, I feel like Kuril Island, okay, she's like, oh yeah, that happened in this book. If I talk about something terrible happening to someone, I'll be like, oh, they're going to get sent to Kuril Island. You know? But these other two things.
I'm positive she had Joel plotted out. Like, just when you read the description of Joel, it is, like, very clear, like, that Joel has, like, more going on mm-hmm. than, like, just... Like, Miles doesn't see it because it's Miles, but, like, to me, as soon as, like, I read those lines, I was like, this is a significant man. And yet he's very in the background. He's very quiet.
Do you think it's because you're a romance reader, Alex?
Yes! Or... Absolutely do. I'm like, I sense romance vibes from Joel. For sure.
That's probably, like, the more correct interpretation. My thought was like, oh, this is Bujold once again giving her characters something that's almost impossible for them to achieve, but then they really want it. And it's almost like their top priority, that thing they want the most. And it's almost impossible. She loves to do that, I've noticed.
like this is, like, Joel is what Miles wanted to be.
In a lot of ways. And then also Joel wants something that's, you know, getting that chip out may be impossible. May have lots of unforeseen consequences that make it not worthwhile.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Shall we talk about the title?
Let's do it.
All right, the Vor game. So I think this is an interesting title. This is a title that makes me like want to think, because like the Vor game, like what's the game in this? The Vor system? Like it would Cordelia call the Vor a game? I don't know. It doesn't seem very gamey. It seems pretty deadly serious.
There was a part kind of toward the when Miles and Cordelia were talking, when he was saying, you know, that being Vor is more than a title and more than, you know, just a position he's in. And she was saying, well, yeah, it's basically a syndrome. You know, it's so much more than what they say it is.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that Cordelia sees the Vor as not something real, the right. way that Errol and Miles and Gregor do. Right. So you're saying like, I could possibly see Cordelia calling it a game. Like, well, this is the Vor game. We're going to play the Vor game. Right. But not right. in the sense that this book gives it. Right. Which is more of like the great game of like nations and.
Right. And the strategies. And the, yeah. Right. The wormhole strategies. And this is right. definitely one of the few books where we see a lot of like strategizing around the wormholes and kind of like the classic, like, you know, sci-fi, you know, military sci-fi, like moving pieces, moving parts, chess pieces kind of thing. I was also thinking about just now as you were saying that about the Vor and like her not really believing in the Vor, the Dendari, the way in this book, Miles is saying to Elena, you know, you and Baz, your safety is the first priority. The Dendari are. And he starts to try to say, you know, aren't important. Or then he starts to try to say aren't real. And he can't bring himself to say either of those things, because to him, they are important and they are real. And so there's a way in which like Miles' duty to the Dendari is very similar to his Vorish duty in his mind. Because, you know, it's his Vor position that allows him to, you know, take them on as his arms people. In Warrior's Apprentice.
Which he wouldn't have really been able to do if he hadn't already had experience doing that with the Dendari.
Yeah.
So, like, that was another funny thing about the whole Kirrell Island episode, was you could see him comparing a lot of the new people that he meets to people he has worked with previously, and it was not a terribly favorable comparison.
Right.
Understandably.
But I think on Kirrell Island, he has this duty, or in his mind, that he has a duty to these fellow soldiers that Metsov is, you know, forswearing, basically. The Metsov isn't putting his soldiers first. It isn't a combat situation. And he, you know, he has a duty to disobey what he sees as a criminal order.
Yeah, but Metsov, too, he's obviously got an issue with the Vor class. Right. So for him, too, he's like, well, maybe this is, I don't know, the Vor game, the Vor get to play these games. I'm the only serious soldier here. Right.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, as usual, this title is really good. She's just great with her titles. So,
yeah, there's definitely a lot of work happening in this title that makes me think about the book in different ways, which is so brilliant. As always.
Yeah. All right. Well, Ruth, thank you so much for joining us. This was really fun. I had a great time talking about the book with you. Sorry you had to drop out a little bit.
Well, I'm sorry too. I'll have to listen back to the episode so I can listen to the part I missed.
But thank you for listening. If you'd like to follow us, Ruth, where can they find you?
Well, I am occasionally on Twitter. At @re_Stearns. And I also have a website, which is restearns.com.
Wonderful.
Where you can find out what I'm up to when I remember to update my blog.
It happens. And Alex, where can they find you?
You can find me everywhere on all social media available at Alexander Vasti.
And you can find me at Plottrists. So again, thank you guys for joining, and we will talk to you next time.
See you next time.